Thanks for listening to this Arrow FM podcast, brought to you with the support of New Zealand On Air.
Greetings, everybody. You're listening to a program called Avant Gardening, coming from the Wairarapa, New Zealand. Our presenters are myself, Margie, and Anna Marie, and Marnie. And in this series of programs, we examine how the world is changing and the effects on gardening and producing food. We'll be looking at different systems and approaches to gardening, their principles and other ideas, as well as examples of these ideas and approaches. So today we're going to start talking about no-dig gardening. And I came across the name Ruth Stout.
She used the, she was the kind of the straw.
She was a straw bale woman, wasn't she?
She used a layer of straw over everything, as opposed to the straw bale thing.
Okay.
She just used a big, thick layer of straw, and it was really thick.
Charles Downey?
Yes, Charles Downey. Yeah, he does a slightly different method. He puts down a heap of cardboard, and then he puts a thick layer of compost over, which you've got to be very careful with some of these methods. That can be very expensive. Straw in New Zealand is expensive. Hay isn't.
It's for seeds.
But I don't care. I don't care about the seeds. We're going to have another little moment here.
Oh, we're getting into territory.
Yeah, no, I have a few issues with the no-dig thing. One is the cost of the compost if you're bringing it in.
I think this depends on how you do. So let's talk a little bit first about what we mean by no-dig.
That's right. Sorry.
So when we talk about no-dig gardening, what is it that we're actually talking about?
We're talking about not jamming a fork in the ground or a spade and turning it over all the time, and that's the thing, isn't it?
Which is, I can feel my grandfather turning in his grave as we speak now, because he religiously turned his garden over, particularly his potato patch.
I inherited a rotary hoe.
There you go.
One of my
religiously turned this thing over, and it would be a job of work.
Oh, yes.
At certain times of the year, he would go up to the garden and go and dig the garden.
There's many knee operations that have come.
And many bad backs and bad tempers too, because it takes a bit of effort. So in terms of no dig, it's about not disturbing those layers. The soil comes in layers. It's got the top, it's got the middle, it's got the subsoil. It's about not disturbing those layers. And why don't we disturb those layers?
Because there's a whole bunch of fungal networks with little mycelium and hyphae. They're all going through the soil, and they're what protect the plants from disease, and they're what add nutrients to the plants, and they're providing all sorts of exciting, yummy things.
And when you turn it over and expose them to the sun, they die.
Yes, they do. They do. And so that's why.
So no-dig garden is a way of retaining the soil life, the microbes in the soil life, minimal disturbance, so it can carry on doing its funky little thing.
There's a few issues I have with that. One, if you have quite a hard clay or quite a hard, silty soil sort of thing that's been quite compacted, and you start dumping big layers of mulch on top of it, not necessarily is that actually going to work quite as quickly as you think it does. Sometimes you go into these things and you dig them up and you go, well, there's a lovely layer of humus on top, but underneath where the soil roots are is still quite hard and compacted. So sometimes if you just get a fork, not necessarily a spade, and definitely not a rotary hoe, and you just gently lift all of that stuff and break it up, you can actually turn it over initially. Oh my goodness, here comes the buggered knee. Hauling in the large amounts of horse poo. I mean, when I do these things, I initially get a lot of stuff into the soil. I get a lot of organic matter into the soil. I start this off with getting that microbial fungal network a really good head start. And then I stop digging. And then it's nice and loose and fluffy, and it's got all the stuff worked into it. And then I start putting hay on top of it.
So no dig is, in your book, no dig is a maintenance technique rather than an initial technique.
Yes.
So the initial technique, same as everything else, the prep is everything.
So do
your digging, turn your soil, include your compost and whatever else it is that you're going to pop in there to...
See, I wouldn't put compost in. I compost in situ. I make huge things of compost, and I add those to my garden beds. But in my food forest, when I do the no-dig thing, I directly add stuff that I'm actually composting in situ. I think compost has got really good attributes to it, but I don't think you need to go through all that process. Why double the work? if not triple the work.
Right, so that's, we are going to have to talk about compost at some point, because there are a whole bunch of techniques around creating, developing, using compost. So that's probably 5 or 6 programs all on its own, quite honestly.
Yes.
So in the case of some of these no-dig beds, you talked there about putting the cardboard down and then putting a significant layer of compost over the top.
It was to kill the grass with the cardboard.
Yeah.
That's right, yeah.
So if you're buying that compost in, then that's a fairly expensive proposition. But I must say, I do a small version of the no-dig garden thing myself. So I have a small potager, a small raised bed garden next to the house. And at the end of the year, when I've taken out all the tomato plants and all the other spent plants that I've been growing all summer, I do turn that soil a little bit. I don't go nuts with it. I get a fork in there and just lift it to aerate it a bit, because over time it compacts down, it drops down. So I get a fork in there and I lift it a little bit and break it up a little bit. It's still in fairly big chunks. And then I put a thick layer of old baleage on.
There we go.
So this baleage is about 4 inches thick, and it covers the entirety of the soil. I wet it down. I wet the soil first, put the baleage on, wet the baleage down, and then I leave it. And then that's the thing for the winter.
Mm.
Obviously not for the winter garden, but for any beds that are dormant, ready for spring, that's how they overwinter. When we get through to the spring, not a lot of the surface of that baleage will have broken down because it's been too cold.
Yep.
But underneath, in that layer, that point where the soil and the baleage are in contact, it's actually started to break down quite nicely.
Be full of worms.
A whole full of worms, yeah. So I just turn it over a little bit just to incorporate some of that baleage into the soil and plant straight into it.
Right, yeah.
That's my spring planting.
So the
top layer of the baleage hasn't broken down, but you leave that
there. The very top hasn't, but where it's in contact with the soil has.
Yeah, but so what are you planting into?
So I turn it over a little bit with the fork.
Okay.
I don't use a spade for this. I just use a fork, and all I'm doing is just flipping a bit of soil onto the top of the
that'll break down baleage more.
And then I just make a wee hole and just plant straight into it. So I'm not digging down to spade depths, as my granddad used to do, where you would dig down to spade depths and you would put one spade depth of the soil onto the previous furrow that you've dug and double digging. And I don't do any of that. Quite frankly, it's too much like hard work, and I've already got a bit of a buggered shoulder, so I am not going to be out there with a spade.
Yeah. But there's a reason too now why we don't.
Oh, yes.
Because of what you just said, that the soil doesn't need to be so disturbed.
Because you don't actually. So the point of double digging originally was to make sure that you put your your compost and your nutritionally rich additives into the soil at the root level where it's going to be used.
Okay. Mm.
So when you were double digging, you were putting that stuff in the level where a plant could access it. It's no good on top. Yeah. It has to be down at that root level, or there has to be something that pulls it down to that root level, which is where your worms come in. So my granddad did this for decades, and many other gardeners and farmers have probably done exactly the same thing as well. I'm lazy. I don't want to work that hard, quite frankly. I don't want to get out there with a spade and double dig all my beds. I'm not interested. What I really want to do is just to clean them all up, pop some baleage on the top, forget about them for 4 months, and then go out in the spring, flick them up a little bit, and plant straight into them. I dig a hole, I put the plant in, I bring the baleage
layer
back over.
And underneath has been
nutritionally
added to.
Yeah, so I just open up a little hole in the baleage and down into the soil, plant whatever it is I'm going to plant, close it all back up again, and I've still got the baleage, most of the baleage on the top there, which acts like a mulch.
Okay.
Particularly in the spring when we've got a lot of rain, because the impact of rain on bare soil is quite detrimental. But if it's got this layer of old baleage on, it's doing a couple of things. It's protecting the soil, it's keeping it that little bit warmer, and it's feeding it.
I remember you once talking about blankets in winter, and that's the thing.
Yeah.
Keep your go.
Yes.
So when they talk about no dig, it's basically saying don't do the big spade story anymore.
No.
Add lots of compost and if you've got your own compost,
or you can compost in situ. You know, you can add horse manure, you can add cow manure, sheep manure, all that sort of thing.
And the leaves. That
we,
You're a little bit careful there about when you add, with the horse poo and other kinds of poo.
When you put them in, if you're going to put them in, then you need you can't plant straight into them because they're
too strong.
Yes. Way too strong, way too hot. So if you're going to do them, then I would probably do something like that in the autumn when I'm going to put these beds to sleep for the winter, put it in there, put the baleage on top, and then just leave them to sit and do their thing so they're ready for spring, plant straight into them.
I think we've talked about before using horse manure to warm, because in the old days those hothouses...
Victorians raised pineapples
yes.
in the UK using hot beds. Of course, at the time they had... Everybody had plenty of horse poo because
everyone had
a
horse.
There was a million horses in London. Yeah. So they made these hot beds, these brick hot beds with the glass tops on, and had a deep, deep bed of horse poo composting, and then these pineapples in buckets or in pots sitting in this thing, and it keeps them warm enough to actually be able to grow a pineapple.
And that's why you see pineapples on some of those old country houses.
Yes.
It was a sign of we were wealthy.
Yep.
We were able to grow pineapples in the UK, winter or wherever it was.
Yes,
but so horse manure, I would imagine all manure, didn't we talk about the cow manure doesn't get as hot as...
If you spread it out, which is what I do, so I don't make big piles of stuff like that, because I think it's a waste to let all of that carbon just disappear into the sky.
Right,
so I spread it out and then cover it up with hay and weeds and all sorts of things. So I compost in situ a lot of the time, because I think that when we compost, we lose a lot of stuff to the atmosphere. You know how your compost pile, if it's just sort of organic matter, it disappears. It gets smaller, 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 smaller. I'd rather have that happening on the garden bed or in the food forest or actually on the soil. That's where I think it does the best benefit. I think I have a little bit of an issue with composting as such sort of thing. I mean, but and you know, there are...
Ooh, you're getting controversial there.
I think we are going to have to have a whole program.
I don't care about the weeds because I spend a lot of time pulling weeds out and then dropping them on the ground. So all of that nutrients is chop and drop, you know, it's just sort of, and I'm always in the garden and things. And yes, it looks a bit messy, but in reality, you've got all of that energy coming from the sun, which is now going into these carbohydrates in the plants, which you're then pulling out and putting back onto the soil. I think when we compost, we lose a lot of that, or a lot of that goodness and things just disappears into the sky. Yes, you can hot compost and get rid of all your weeds if you want to do that, but I think the work that goes into just yanking out a few weeds and turning compost and making a proper hot compost, I think it kind of either balances out or I'm kind of in credit here.
But I wanted to get back to the straw stuff. So there are different types, obviously.
You can get barley straw, you can get pea straw. They can be upwards of $10, $12 a bale.
I was going to ask you, where do you get all this stuff
from? We used to get it from, when they did peas here before the pea weevil came in, we used to get it from a farmer out on the thing. But then it was so expensive that now what I do is, coming up to hay season, I get old hay from farmers who want to clear out their hay barns.
That haven't used their hay from last year.
And then I say, look, I'll either pay you a dollar a bale, and sometimes I go, well, you know what, I just want you to come and get it, I don't care. And then we, you know, do that obviously with a big trailer, and then haul that back. And then often I don't cut the bales up initially. If they're huge, big, round bales, then yes, I will cut those and then lay it down on the ground in big wadges and things. But that is a massive amount of work. The little rectangular bales, they're great because, A, I can lift them into place, pop them down on the ground. In spring, I'll plant a little pumpkin that I've grown in the glasshouse, a little pumpkin seedling, in behind that hay bale to protect it from the sun and the wind, and then that'll grow and it'll get its roots in underneath this rotting hay bale. I can put some chicken manure on top of the hay bale, some ash from the hot tub, the wood-fired hot tub, on top of that hay bale as well to provide more nutrients as it's going down. The pumpkin gets its roots in underneath that hay bale as it's rotting. And if you turn it over, it is beautiful under there. There's worms going berserk.
Hay bales are fantastic.
Hay bales are fantastic. So
if you can get hold of them.
If you can get hold of them, yes. So and then now what I'm about to do is I've got a heap of cardboard and newspaper, and I'm going to cut those hay bales, take the strings out, and then get the big Weet-Bix wadgy things, put the because now my pumpkins have come out, and this is in the food forest, so there's little trees everywhere as well. The pumpkins all grew in underneath the little trees because they've got, you know, the watermelons and things, because they've got, you know, there's lots of space because they're caught, kept short. And then put the newspaper and the cardboard down to squash the weeds down, and then I cut those hay bales up and then put the little Weet-Bixes, you know what I'm talking about when I'm talking about Weet-Bix, and pop them down on top of the cardboard and the newspaper, and that just kills all the weeds. Yes, the hay can sometimes grow weeds. I don't care. Yes. I just don't care about that at all.
Well, I mean, it's the same with certain kinds. I mean, when we were in Wellington, we went zoo poo.
Oh, yes,
to grow wonderful weed gardens.
Yeah.
Get some zoo poo. Because
apparently, I remember them advertising this a few years ago, the zoo poo. And apparently, if you get the zoo poo that's from the big cats, it helps to keep domestic cats out of your garden.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Because they smell this and go, oh, tiger in the neighbourhood. I better make myself scarce.
That's wonderful. Okay.
I've no idea if that actually works or not.
I don't know. I just remember getting it, and it produced so many weeds, and I couldn't work it out, and I then realised it was the poo. But now, so you can get pea straw. I have to make a terrible confession. When we came here, there was an old shed in the back, and it did have a few bales of pea stuff, but they were starting to rot, and we hadn't got into the gardening yet. And we gave it away. I know.
Oh,
am I allowed to make confessions?
No, no.
But yes, so pea straw you don't really get anymore. Well,
not
you can. You can, but it's the last time I saw it advertised, it was $20 a bale.
Whoa,
it's
very expensive.
Which is stupidly expensive.
Much cheaper.
Honest, I never had an awful lot of luck with pea straw. So one of the reasons that I went to the old baleage was because I have some, but also because when I'd used pea straw in the past, I'd ended up with a horrendous slug problem.
Oh, right.
Yeah. So I ended up with a lot of slugs, and also pea straw comes with a lot of pea plants, so you end up with some free peas, but they're not necessarily the peas that you want to eat.
No.
Yeah.
We had lovely sweet peas this year.
Yeah.
And I think I told you a story. My son tried to eat one pod and nearly poisoned himself. Oh. But anyway, the rabbit across the road loves sweet pea straw. So I just picked it all out. We have a very friendly Easter bunny who lives across the road. He's about the size of a small dog. He's huge anyway. Called Moose.
Speaking of which, rabbit, if you've got rabbits, the hutch straw that comes out of that, the poo, guinea pig poo is fantastic for that too.
Okay.
There's also things like leaves. You can make no dig with, we make it with an enormous range of stuff. We use a huge pile of leaves. I've got, I think, well over 2,000 canners in the cut them all down about this time of the year. So they're going in on top of the food forest, you know, the ground.
Yeah, and that also breaks down.
It does. It does, and it's really, really good because
No dig, the whole idea underneath it is layers of organic matter.
Yeah, and it can be anything. Yeah.
It's about protecting the soil.
Yeah.
It's about feeding the soil. Without the need to dig down
and to do
to incorporate that stuff down to
your
two spade depths of
you can use arborist mulch as well. But there is a bit of a thing when you look on YouTubes, especially if they've come from America, they talk a lot about getting this free arborist mulch. It doesn't exist in New Zealand it's very, very expensive to buy it in New Zealand. So just be aware. If you're going to go into making a food forest or no dig and you're looking at using arborist mulch, it is. And if you're in New Zealand, it is going to cost you quite a bit of money.
Mm.
Or you can be like us and make your own.
See, I wouldn't use arborist mulch for any of that kind of stuff because I it's just too big. It's just too chunky.
No, we use it all the time. But we do have an enormous industrial mulcher that goes on the back of a tractor.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well, some of us don't have all this machinery.
I know.
Yeah. For us regular, normal human beings. Yes.
Well, just leaves. Leaves is great.
Well, we've got enough leaves here because we're surrounded by deciduous trees. Mm, every tree around here, I giggle at because you rake it up and the next day they're all there. They're obviously waiting for you to clear the pathway and then they'll fall.
Yeah.
But yes. Now, one of the other things we have a bit of time I wanted to ask you about is biochar
Oh, that's a whole other program.
Oh, yes. Oh, good Lord.
Yes. Oh, Lordy, Lordy, Lordy. Yeah,
there are some very definite pro and con camps to when we talk about biochar.
Yeah.
There are some, not just the chemical side of it, but there's some of the, as Anna likes to call it, the woo-woo side of it,
yeah,
of biochar. That is a whole programme. Yeah.
Well, because it led on to when you were talking about, you know, fruit forests, and they talked about terra preta, which, yeah, comes out of the Amazon idea that the soil there is very dark and it was all the stuff that had been fallen plants, et cetera, et cetera,
yeah,
and adding charcoal.
I think they were burning bits of rainforest, to be quite honest.
Well, that's the problem. Yeah, that's we won't go down that road.
But that has always happened, like, and the same in Australia, and the same all over the planet. Forest fires happen.
Yes.
And if you're going to introduce charcoal into the soil, it's probably because something got hit by a lightning strike and there was a bit of a food forest, and ergo, charcoal.
Yeah.
It's not, I don't think that that's something, I don't think some chap came along one day and went, oh, look, charcoal. I honestly think it's one of those things where people went, actually, Amazonian forest, rainforest, it has spent tens of thousands of years with leaves falling off and dead animals falling off trees and the occasional fire here and there. And it cannot help but create an incredibly rich soil.
Yes.
Because it's not just raining rain, it's, yeah, raining, mm, nutrition constantly,
yeah,
onto the floor of the forest.
Yeah.
So it can't help but be incredibly rich and,
yes,
and very diverse in what, yeah, it contains.
Mm. So we'll keep that maybe for the next time. But I just, mm, want to make one other comment. When you're talking about fires, because, you know, in South Africa, especially the Western Cape, gets these dreadful fires. And it's got natural fauna, which is very unique. You know, your proteas and your ericas and all this sort of stuff. And it regenerates. And, mm, some of them actually need fire, mm, to spread their seed and stuff.
Yep.
And give it a couple of years and it's back to what it was.
Mm.
And it's amazing. I mean, you sort of think, this will never grow again. But it does. And, mm, that must have been done something to the soil.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it's amazing.
Gorse is a really good example of that. I mean, I know gorse is a number no-no. One enemy for a lot of people, but one of the reasons, the seeds are incredibly tough. They can survive for a very, very long time in the soil. And actually, even if fire comes through, all it does is opens up the seed casings, the,
yes,
seeds fall to the ground, and then in a season or two, up it comes.
Yeah.
It's incredibly hard to get rid of.
But I have a bit of an issue with gorse as well. I think people are smacking gorse with a stick and chemicals and whatever. Just leave it alone. Use it as a nurse plant. You know, you've got a very valuable resource sitting on your property here.
Well,
if you want to set
how
up
much
a,
of it you've got.
Well, yeah, we're doing
acres. You've got
200
acres of it. You might, yeah, want to give it a bit of a go, you know.
But eventually, if you want to go back to, you know, people go, oh, they're cutting out the gorse so they can plant natives. They go, just leave the gorse alone. Then the manuka will come up through it, and then the other trees, and then it will shade it out, and then it will die naturally.
No dig gardening.
There we go.
Ah, there we are. Mm. But this is one other thing you mentioned in it, rotavators. You've had your experiences with rotavators, and I've mentioned, yeah, how Donald dug up a whole paddock with a rotavator, a big heavy one,
yes, yeah,
and he didn't get the grass out, so we still had to rake it and everything, but he got a very good garden out of it eventually.
Mm.
But that was to try and dig up all that grass. Mm. And it was
right,
paddock.
There's, okay, better ways to get rid of grass.
Yeah,
though.
There's much easier ways. You mean,
what's that terrible chemical?
Not
the roundabout. You know,
yeah,
cardboard newspaper.
Look, cardboard, yeah,
mulch.
Covering,
yeah,
it, yeah, stopping its access to light, reducing its access to water, mm, that'll do it.
Yes. Well, that's the base of what no-dig gardening.
Yes.
So we've actually covered quite a lot of areas. We've got a few, yeah, more minutes. So, anything else you'd like to say before we would jump into composting or something else next,
yeah,
time?
We
those are big topics.
Yes, I think composting is a huge topic because there's a lot of different damage. People do it in a lot of different ways. I think mm, you do it quite differently to how,
yes,
to, yeah, how I do, yeah, it. I've tried a number of different techniques. But I think the critical thing, just to get back to the no-dig again for a second, the critical thing with the no-dig thing is not disturbing the soil. When you plant plants, you do it, you create a little hole, you pop your plant in, and when you take those plants out later on, you don't dig a bloody great hole to do it. You just pull the plants out with the roots, cover it back up, and then cover the soil again. It's important that the soil stays covered. It's important that it has that. Like, even in the summer when it's warm, because the sun kills that soil life, if you've got it covered, it doesn't get the opportunity to do that.
Oh, fantastic. Well, thank you, too. We got through without too much...
Nobody died.
Still friends. So we'll continue later. Okay, thank you very much.